It is time for the Science Files. Get ready with your questions for Rob Thacker. He's ready for you. We had a chat. I can tell he's on his A game. When isn't he, right? That's right. Astronomy and physics professor at St. Mary's University, Rob Thacker, in studio. Rob, how thrilled are you to be here right now on a scale of 1 to 10 with the factor Rick not being here?
Oh, let's turn it up to an 11. How are you doing?
Well. So we saw each other, I think, last week on the golf course here in Avid Golf.
Yeah.
I think we talked about that quite a bit, and you said that your drives are pretty good right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, that's my strength. Yeah. I played golf a lot when I was a kid. I really enjoyed it, and I got pretty good, actually, but then I quit when I was a teenager. But I was always playing with kids that were older than me.
Yes.
And so because they were older than me, they were hitting it farther, so I always tried to really, really hit it really far. I didn't always hit it very straight, but I always was known for hitting it a long way, and that's mm-hmm. still the case now.
Excellent. So speaking of that, golf has a lot to do with physics, right? Obviously,
physics absolutely.
Is a huge component
to it. It's all physics, yeah.
It's all physics, isn't it?
Yeah.
So the compression of the golf ball.
Yep.
The golf ball, people, I think what you realize, it actually squishes together on impact,
oh,
right?
Oh, yeah.
And what's happening on the face of the golf club itself, is that also compressing in some
yeah,
way?
Yeah, that is. So you've got two separate compression waves. This is so amazing. It's all physics. You have two separate
total
compression
physics
waves.
Geek stuff right
yeah,
here.
Yeah, and one goes through the golf ball itself and squishes the golf ball up. But you also get another compression wave that goes back through the face of the club. And depending upon how you hold that, you can actually slow that down a little bit. So a lot of the modern clubs do slow that down, especially the what are called woods, but they're not. They're made of metal now. And so if you slow that down, you actually hold it on the club face for longer and import more energy into the golf ball. And that's one of the reasons why clubs today hit the ball so far compared to when I was growing up. It's kind of made the game easier, right? Because literally it goes 40 yards further now than it did when I was a kid, right? And so all of that is game because of engineering physics and understanding exactly what's happening as the golf ball hits the face of the golf club.
Right. So the golf ball, it continues to compress and squish, I guess, to use that term, as the club face is pushing through. And the longer you hold that line going through, the more distance and energy you're creating, is that right?
The longer it's on the club face, the more energy you're actually imparting to it.
Yeah. So if you're hitting it and you're not square and you're hitting it and you're creating less compression and more spin, that's called a hook or a slice. That's what's resulting there.
Yeah, that's right. So if you, well, we'll get into the technical side of this really quickly. To get what you're calling a hook, you actually have to impart as much side spin onto the ball as you need in a given direction. So if you're doing a hook, if you're looking down from above, you would be spinning it in an anti-clockwise direction. And you do that basically by, as you said, having the face away from being exactly square on to going towards the target to being sort of like turned to the left of the target and moving across the ball. And that it's the same as like a slice shot in tennis, as you sort of like shape the racket around the ball and put side spin on. It's the same thing in golf.
Yeah, exactly. So when it comes to sports, a lot of these principles, and I find with golf people don't consider them, but the principles of athleticism and all of what you're talking about, a slap shot, hitting a baseball, it's all the same, is it not, basically?
Yeah, very much. And so sports biomechanics is becoming a big thing. And what they will tell you is when they analyze an athlete's movements, you get a lot of similarities from sport to sport. I mean, people probably can see there are similarities between baseball and golf, right? And so how you plant your left foot in baseball as you take the step and then hit the ball in baseball, there's a lot of similarities to that and the actual hitting motion in golf, that the strength you have in your left side and you rotate around that left side gives you the hit in baseball and the hit in golf as well. And so you can look at how that's most efficient. There's tons of papers written on this. We actually have one of the most world-famous experts in this, a guy called Seisho McKenzie, is at NFFX up the road in Antigonish. So there's a lot of people do studies on this, and there's actually quite a lot of money in it, too.
Yeah, there is. But it annoys people sometimes when they see somebody who's small in stature, perhaps. They don't perhaps appear like they're athletic, but they go out there and they just create all of this speed.
Yep.
So the question is it happening?
Yeah, no. So this is really great because this is about trying to move as efficiently as possible, right? So you can have someone who's like 5'6", who nonetheless hits a baseball or a golf ball an absolute country mile. And the reason they can do that is because they have what we call a good kinematic sequence. And that is basically how you use your muscle groups one on top of another to put the most efficient hit on the ball as you can. And so in golf and in baseball, you start off with power coming from the legs, which is then transmitted through to your hips. You've got your spine as well connecting you to your hips. So you then get rotational speed from the torso. Then from the torso, you've got your shoulders. Finally, from your shoulders, you've got your wrists all the way down to the club head. And how those things all basically add on top of one another determines how efficient you are. Right. And if you're really, really efficient, then you can draw a graph and you'll see that as each one sort of like gets its maximum, the other one kicks in. And someone who hits the ball incredibly far has that perfect sequence.
Absolutely. Not to turn this into a sports segment, but something I wanted to ask you, and it's physics related as well. It makes no sense to me. When a pitcher is throwing 98, 99, whatever, 92, 85 miles an hour, and he's releasing that ball, you would think in the time, I don't know how long it takes to leave his hand to get to the, how anybody could process all of that, get the location, get pick up the spin, and make that happen. I have no idea. But I can only assume a lot of it is being set up with the arm angle, with the way that the pitcher is coming through the ball. Is the hitter starting to pick up signals? How quickly is the pitcher's motion leading to information gathering from the hitter?
Okay, there's a couple of things.
I don't know if that makes sense
or not.
No,
I know exactly what you're talking about. This is talked about in lots of different games as well, because you actually don't have enough time to consciously process what's going on.
Right?
And so particularly, for example, with throwing a baseball, hitting a baseball, whatever, all of that sequencing that you're doing is not conscious. You're not thinking, I've got to do this, got to do that, got to do that, because you can't. You literally can't think it that quickly. The brain basically takes about 0.2 seconds to consciously think through something, whereas that whole motion to throw a baseball, that's taking 0.2 seconds anyway. And so what you've actually done is you have trained your neurons to fire in a way that doesn't require your conscious processing. And it's the same with hitting. Right. I used to play cricket a lot as well, being English. And so people were wondering, how do cricket players know where the ball is going?
Right.
And you're right. They're actually integrating all of the cues that they're getting from watching the person coming down and then figuring out from all of that, anticipating sometimes, like with cricket, especially because the ball bounces before you hit it, which can be
variable.
More crazy. So there you're trying to integrate as many things as possible. But it's the same thing going on, though. I mean, how do you know whether someone's throwing a curveball or a slider or just a straight fast? That you often don't know, and that's why pitchers swing and miss.
Yeah.
But you try and guess it, and sometimes you get it right.
And the great pitchers have the ability to make all of that look the same, whether it's a changeup or a fastball or whatever it is. They don't alter that motion.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
And so it's the same in tennis. Right?
Yeah.
The good servers, whether they're going down the line or a slice out wide, they throw the ball up the same way.
Right.
But the players who don't do that, who change their throw, for example, for the different serve, they can be read by other players. And so, in generally, they're considered to be less good servers.
It's fascinating, isn't it, though?
Yeah,
it truly is. Because, anyway, it's great stuff.
Yeah, I could talk about this for
hours. But physics and sports is I mean, they're beyond connected, right? It is sports.
It's all sports. I mean, the other thing that I like to point out is people think they can't do calculus, but you're actually doing calculus every time you go and catch a ball.
Right.
Right? Because you're predicting where it's going to go on the basis of how something travels.
But if you were to have a task to try and write that out on paper or in a computer program, then we're getting down into some other issues, right?
Yeah.
So, by the way, we have our phone lines are open, of course, if you have questions for Rob Thacker. That's what we do, 902-405-6000 or 877-801-8255. And, Bob, you've given us a call, so you have the first crack. Go ahead, Bob. How are you?
I'm doing fine, and boy, I've been golfing for 50 years, and when I broke 100, I got excited.
Well, that's good, but you should.
Hey, Bob, how are you doing?
Not too bad, and believe it or not, I'm going to ask about the moon.
Okay.
I listened to BBC, but there was an article in the Globe and Mail, too, about, and scientists have said it's baffling to them, there was two great big cave-ins. So my question is there a core in that may be active in the moon that maybe has moved or did something to possibly melt ice or move water that's under the moon to make these cave in? Because no activities on the moon that I understand. So yeah. I kind of leave it up to you.
Yeah, so you're right, actually, that the moon is essentially fairly, well, is essentially not geologically active. It seems to have, you can kind of think of planets and moons as sort of like having mushy cores and solidifying over time as heat goes out. They literally cool down and solidify. So the moon seems to have reached that point. But the thing to remember is you'll have lava tubes and things like that on the surface of the moon that were left there a very, very long time ago. And it just may take a long period of time for things to become structurally unstable. And that's probably what's happening in this case, I would guess, that you have something that's a lava tube that's been there for a very, very long time. And literally things just kind of fall down off of it. There's sort of like very, very slow processes of things becoming unstable. You could kind of think it's like erosion, but it's not quite the same as that. So that would be my guess. I haven't seen this particular report myself, but you're right to say that the moon is actually not structurally active anymore. It's pretty dormant from that perspective.
Well, one other question then. Is there a heated core in the moon?
There would have been in the past, but as far as I'm aware now, the moon is considered to be pretty much solidified. Yeah,
a dead planet.
Yeah. Oh, moon.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you very much.
You got it. Take care. Again, questions for Rob Thacker, 902-405-6000 or 877-801-8255. We will continue to take calls when we come back. Well, I think Rob Thacker tried to do something on his computer. I think he's tried to send an email or something, but I talked his ear off the entire time asking questions. Did I annoy you, Rob?
No. I was trying to send an email to you.
Because the reports are that I can be annoying from time to time.
I'll comment at the end.
Anyway, you were trying to send me an email. I'll give you some time at the bottom of the hour send me an email. So I'm alone.
You
guy.
Should have it now, actually.
Okay. Questions for Rob Thacker. 902-405-6000 or 877-801-8255. This is, of course, The Science Files. Wayne, how are you this lovely Monday morning?
Very, very well.
Excellent.
I hope the both of you are the same.
We are doing
good,
fantastic.
You,
not a complaint.
I struggled with physics when I was in high school, so I'll keep that in mind.
You're not alone, Wayne. You're not alone.
And that's okay. Don't feel bad.
But what I want to know is when the people of NASA, the engineers and the scientists, were computing orbits for the moon and those kinds of things, would they have used Newton's actual equations or at least his theories, and to what extent?
Yes, absolutely. And so one of the things that I like to tell people is that as awesome as Einstein's theory of general relativity, which is the best theory of gravity that we have, Newton's laws are actually still amazingly accurate for things like space travel. You don't need anything more than Newton's laws to go from the Earth to the moon and back again safely. And so, yes, when they were doing the calculations of what happens as the spacecraft travels from the Earth to the moon, they will have indeed have been solving equations that were laid out by Newton hundreds of years ago. So the precise way they formulate it may be a little bit different because we now have a lot better tools for doing the mathematics than Newton had available at his time, particularly a course that I teach, actually, students in third year, allows us to lay out the particular conceptual framework that Newton's laws work in much better than Newton would have had known in his time. But nonetheless, absolutely, they were indeed solving equations that Newton would have been able to understand.
Modify one or many of his laws?
Yeah, so Einstein modified things in a way that's really a major step forward. It wasn't just taking equations and making them a little bit more complicated. What Einstein did was to make us think entirely differently about what gravity actually is, to going from this idea of forces between things to being this really sort of like weird and way out concept of being the curvature of space and time. But nonetheless, that allows us to understand how different, what appear to be different forces, in fact produce the same result when you actually experience them. So Einstein made a really significant step forward. The mathematics behind Einstein's theory of general relativity is much, much more complicated than Newton's theory. In fact, I would say that the math to do Einstein's theory didn't really exist until probably maybe just a little bit over 100 years ago. And so the conceptual framework that Einstein developed really needed the mathematics to be developed.
One of the sides of that was that I listened to a podcast by the Interplanetary Society, and women who were using computers that weighed over 40 pounds back in the day, mm-hmm. They didn't have a name for them, so they called them computresses.
Wayne, let me ask you this. You're listening to a podcast with, what's the name of the podcast again?
It's Interplanetary Society.
Okay, you're listening to Interplanetary Society podcast and you weren't good at physics in school? Something happened to you, right?
I'm probably better today than I was then.
No. Okay, I'm going to jump in because this is what I like. So the thing to remember is you may not be great at the equations. You may not be great at the math. You may have trouble grabbing the concepts. But if you're still curious and you still carry on reading about something, that is the most important thing. Because being curious and wanting to get the answer is the thing that really drives us as human beings.
I have no problem being curious.
Yeah, okay.
Did that take care of your question, Wayne?
That does. Thanks so much.
Okay, thanks
for the
a
time.
Lot. You got it. And you make a great point because I can remember being in high school and I was just, I don't want to say typical teenage boy because that's, I don't want to impugn all teenage boys, but I was particularly lazy and I'll just call it what it is when it comes to academics. So therefore you say, I'm not good at math. I'm not good at physics. I'm not, because you're not working. You're not interested at it. That's
right? There's many different ways that can manifest. Like there are some people who don't want to fail. Mm-hmm. And so they say, I won't even try.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. So you get all of that. I mean, school is a really difficult situation right now. I mean, it sounds like a cliche, but I hate the fact that grades become this thing that everyone worries about because grades become the thing that stop you being curious about something. Because as soon as you're worried about the grade that you get, you stop worrying about having, I'm going to use the fun word. I believe that learning can be fun. And like, I do this because I enjoy it. I'm not doing this because I'm getting paid, because I'm not getting paid. I'm doing this because it's fun and I want to tell people about it. And so when you take that out of the equation and it becomes this thing that you have to do to get a grade, to get a piece of paper, to go to university, to get a job and so on, then it's no surprise that people struggle. And it's one of the reasons why the best schools, if we could really organize everything differently in the education system, if you allowed people to basically set the course that they take and to explore things at their own pace with the supports they need, that's how you're most efficient. That's what happens in research. You literally do find your own way through things. You gather the things together that you're interested in, and then you go through it from that perspective. Of course, sometimes people have a question they want solved, but a lot of the blue skies research, the kind of stuff we do in astronomy, is driven fundamentally by curiosity.
Do you think part of the problem is that somebody walks into a chemistry class or something, they're new to it, and they see these equations on the board and physics textbook, and they're I can't do this, right? They don't understand that it's incremental learning and there's a process to get there. Maybe there's something to do with that, the stimuli of it?
Sure. There are some personality types that will be overwhelmed and think, I can't get there. I certainly remember starting the last 2 years of math in high school and seeing the problems we're going to do and thinking, oh, I'm never going to be able to do that.
Panic.
But the steps that we went through to get there in the end were actually fairly manageable. Okay, I was obviously a fairly bright kid. But nonetheless, I've been through that. And there still are people in my own field who suffer from this thing called imposter syndrome, who think that they can't do something, they're not as good as the people around them and so on. And yet when they really put their mind to it, they can do it. So the difference is probably whether you have enough sort of like preparedness to fail and go out and try as opposed to thinking, I'm going to fail. I just won't try anyway.
And that's all, of course, ties in with parenting and all types of other variables.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it annoys some students when I stand up and say, look, you have to be prepared to fail. Right? Because the perfection that grades sort of like drives you toward means that you kind of are worried about making any mistakes. Yeah. I played sports with like 10-year-olds who, when they make a mistake, they just break down. And that's bad. That's not good for our society when that happens, because we learn more when we fail than when we succeed. Right.
Absolutely.
And that is the thing that we tell students.
That's my philosophy every day is I'm going to fail.
Well, if you go into business, right, one of the catchphrases for entrepreneurship now is fail fast, fail often.
Yeah.
Get the things that aren't going to work out of the way and then find the thing that does.
Absolutely. Okay, we have another half hour with Rob Thacker and the Science Files. We want to hear from you as well. We've had some great questions so far. Want to hear some more of them? 902-405-6000. That's the way to reach us and have those questions for Rob. Again, 902-405-6000 or 877-801-8255. We'll continue with the Science Files after the news. It is a Monday. That means it's the Science Files, and Rob Thacker is here in studio with us, astronomy and physics professor. of those two categories, which one do you prefer the most, astronomy or physics? And I know there's ties into both.
So if I'm completely honest, I am technically an astrophysicist, and I don't think I've ever done a course in proper astronomy.
Oh, is that right, eh?
Yeah, so everything I know about astronomy, I've kind of had to learn on the fly once I sort of moved closer and closer to astronomy.
Okay, so physics.
Physics, then. I teach.
Hands down.
Yeah, I teach physics. I have taught some courses in astronomy, like introductory courses in astronomy, but I would never say I'm an astronomer. Like, there are plenty of amateur astronomers who know a lot more about the constellations than I do.
Right.
But obviously, my specialty is understanding physics and how that applies to astronomical objects. So that makes me an astrophysicist.
So I would think that if somebody were studying engineering, would they? You must have engineering students taking some of your courses, do you? Or?
Oh, yes, very much so. I mean, so particularly in second year, we have students who come in who are in the engineering stream and actually will do courses in physics. Physics and engineering are obviously very tied together. In fact, so the really interesting thing is how different doing engineering in North America is versus doing engineering in the UK. In the UK, you can still kind of go into engineering through doing a physics degree. And so we used to joke that the physics degree in the UK was a Swiss Army degree because you could do anything with it at the end, right? Whereas over here, to become a professional engineer, then you have to have a degree in engineering, right? So you're really streamed into engineering comparatively early on over here compared to in the UK, where you can do physics and then sort of go into it once you get to grad school. So that puts a different sort of like viewpoint on what you're doing with your undergrad degree, whereas we kind of look at them as more general in the UK, whereas they're kind of a bit more specialist over here. And so, yeah, nonetheless, we have a lot of engineering students sitting in on our first and second year courses.
Absolutely, yeah. I would think so. Okay, again, questions for Rob Thacker, 902-405-6000 or 877-801-8255. I do want to get to this email that he sent. It's about an asteroid, and we all know when we hear City Killer, and that caught my attention, so whoever wrote the headline knew what they were doing. I want to get to that, but let's go to the phones first. Tim, how are you?
Hi, very good.
Excellent.
I just had a question about the tides. I've been down south a couple of times, down around Cuba and whatnot, and it just doesn't seem like there's a big differential between the low tides and the high tides, and I was wondering if that's because of the shape of the ground, or if it's the moon just doesn't have as much effect there.
You got it. It's all down. Really, the biggest factor is going to be local geography, right? And so that's one of the reasons why, for example, the Bay of Fundy is this incredible ecosystem with these incredible tides. And so what you have to remember is that if you have a way of moving water and then bringing it back again, which is essentially kind of what happens with tides, although the Earth is spinning as well to make it a little bit more complicated. But if you have a system that's set up, so if the amount of water you move in the same amount of time as the moon is effectively being changed by the position being changed by the rotation of the Earth, then you can have a situation where you have something that in physics parlance is called a resonance. When those two particular time periods correspond, you'll get a really strong, I'll call it sloshing, right? Everyone knows, yeah, you slosh water in the bath as you sort of drive it at the same sort of like amount of times it takes to go from one end to the other, then you can make a bigger and bigger and wave. And that's essentially going to be the thing that amplifies up the tides to be really crazily high. Like, I mean, if I didn't believe how high the tides were in Fundy when I was a physics student in the UK. I thought, oh, I can't believe it. And then you come here and then you see it, and it's just mind-blowing. And that is all about the local geography, changing how the water flows and making it be in perfect resonance with the actual lunar tides.
I have a question for you myself. Yeah. We have other calls too, by the way.
Yeah,
but because I'm running the show, I'm going to ask.
You're kidding. Putting your foot down.
That's right. No, there's a tie in here. So the moon does not create energy itself, correct? It's a dead sphere. Is that accurate?
From a thermal perspective, yes. But it's still spinning. It's still rotating.
Right. So there would be some energy, right? But so when it the Earth or the moon is not creating gravity, again, perhaps, this is my theory, and you can quash it now. It's more the displacement of energy in its where it is in relation to the sun and the way it displaces that energy around it. Is that is what creating the gravity?
Okay. So what creates gravity is just mass. Having mass.
Mass, right.
Right? So the stuff, just stuff, has gravity, right?
Yes.
The property of having this weird thing that when you try and move it, you feel it's heavy.
So it is displacing energy then?
It has this natural sort of like this energy that's going out there all the time in the gravitational field.
Right.
If you throw something on the moon, it comes back down. That force of gravity is there all the time, so that energy is there. When we were talking about the thermal energy of the moon, that's just heat energy.
Right.
There are many energy comes in many different forms.
Okay.
Like things like gravity, anything that's moving has kinetic energy, as we call it, the energy of motion. And then you have thermal energy, which is kind of related in a funny kind of way to kinetic energy, but it's not trivial. So yeah, the moon still has energy. It has gravitational energy that's being out there all the time. And so you were saying how the moon relates to the alignment of the sun and tides. The two of them can work together. Mm-hmm. And that's how you get the big spring tides, as they're called,
right,
when the sun and the moon are both putting their tidal forces, which are a product of gravity, together.
Okay. So was I way, way off base, or was there anything even close? And you can.
There was a
can
sensible question in there that I got to.
That was a kind way of saying it didn't make much sense, but I bailed you out.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for
no
that. 902-405-6000 or 877-801-8255. Bonita, how are you?
Good, good.
Excellent.
My question is, good morning, gentlemen.
Hey, Bonita.
My question is, if the sun or any of the other planets were to, I don't know, somehow move differently than they move now, would that affect the Earth? And like, would it? Would we be gone, or would it, like, especially the sun, would we sort of be wiped out? Okay.
Benita, okay. I'm going to ask you to move your hand and turn your radio down if you would do that, because we're hearing the echo. It's on a delay. Can you do that for us?
How's that?
That is excellent.
That's better.
Okay, go ahead.
So I get the question, Benita, and the short answer is, if your gut feeling is if we move the sun, the Earth is going to have to moon, is absolutely right, right? So the balance of where the Earth is orbiting around the sun is set by, as we were just talking, essentially the forces of gravity. So if you moved the sun, you would actually change the what we call the orbital stability of the Earth. So the sun is moving comparatively quickly, I would say, around the center of the Milky Way. It orbits every few hundred million years. But the point is, the Earth is moving around with that as well. But if you suddenly sort of like moved the sun very, very quickly, right, then yes, we would actually have to respond to that. But the good news is, we can't think of any way that you would do that. So we're pretty much safe.
I don't know. There's all kinds of stuff pushing and pulling on stuff in outer space. If something were to hit the sun, another, I don't know, star or something.
Absolutely. If another star came through our solar system somehow, right, then you're right. That would have a really big impact. In fact, if another star got very close to our solar system, we'd be knowing about that probably quite a bit before it hit the sun, right? So your gut feeling is right. So the Earth and the sun are in what we call a sort of like stable orbit. But if something came along to what we technically would say perturb that, then yes, absolutely, that would impact the way the Earth was moving as well.
What if the other planets, like if one of them were thrown off their orbit, would that affect us?
But potentially. With that, it would depend upon which planet it was. Like, for example, if Jupiter was to be moved like a little bit more in towards the sun, that would have a very big effect because Jupiter is the biggest planet in the solar system. But something like Pluto, you could probably move Pluto pretty much anywhere, and that wouldn't have a very significant effect.
Pluto gets picked on, doesn't it?
Poor old Pluto. Pluto's cool. Pluto is Pluto. It's just way out there and really, really cold and really cool.
The planet is not a planet. It's
it's a dwarf planet. Yeah. So
thanks, Benita.
Okay.
I appreciate it. All right, let's get another call. Kathy, how are you today?
I'm fine, thank you.
Excellent. Go ahead.
Okay. In the latest issue of Maclean's, they've got a whole thing on global warming.
Mm-hmm.
And they're stating that Atlantic Canada has the largest local sea level rising in the country, and we're shrinking about a millimeter per year. And by 2100, people visiting Peggy's Cove Lighthouse will be soaking wet because it sits only 5 meters above sea level. Why are we going to have all those problems in southern Atlantic Canada?
So I'm going to be honest and say I'm not an expert on this, but there's a couple of possible factors involved in why you can have more localized sea level rise. And that is if the landmass that you're on is actually going down as well as the sea level coming up. And so if you're, for example, you can have a situation where following all of the glaciers that were in the Ice Age, they actually are allowing some parts of the land to respond and sort of like rebound, bounce back up, as it were. But other parts can be going down in response to that on the surface of the Earth. So I don't know if it's true, but it could be the case that in Nova Scotia, we actually are part of the bit that's going down in response to the other bit that's rising. And so when you combine that with the sea level rise, then you get a more significant issue. But it's not going to be as quite as big as the actual amount of sea level rise, is my understanding. But I don't know. I'm not a geologist. I would have to defer to an expert on that. So there are things that can happen locally that can increase the impact of sea level rise as well.
Okay, thank you very much.
No thank problem. You, Kathy. Okay. It amazes me, actually, the equilibrium, if that's the right term, it probably isn't, of the Earth, though, right? It's truly stunning, is it not?
Oh, so this is the thing, right? That one of the issues with climate change is that the equilibrium that the Earth is in is really complicated, right? Mm-hmm. And we don't understand. Well, I don't want to say we don't understand it in a way that suggests we're just bumbling around and clueless, because that's not true. But there are a lot of really technical issues of like how much carbon is stored in the Arctic, for example, right? That we don't understand. And the other problem with the equilibrium that we have is how does it respond if it's pushed away? Mm-hmm. With an equilibrium, if it's pushed away, it's meant to come back again. But you can have equilibriums where once you push a system too far, then it doesn't come back.
Right. It's not in equilibrium anymore.
It's not in equilibrium anymore, and it's going to go off and find another equilibrium that's probably very different to the first one that it was in. Yeah. And that is the challenge that we have right now in trying to understand climate change, that all of this CO2, as it gets sort of like into the atmosphere and it starts increasing the greenhouse effect, then there are many things where we can think of, like increased wildfires that we're having. We're seeing that in the Arctic. We're seeing that in North America as well. All of that carbon that gets released actually ends up moving you faster away from the equilibrium in what's called a feedback process. And that's why climate scientists are kind of nervous, because we don't understand that, because it's complicated and it's what we call nonlinear. It can get worse much faster than you think it might. And that's got climate scientists very worried, because, and a lot of skeptics are very sort of laugh when I say this, but I genuinely think that climate scientists tend to be quite conservative.
So when you say skeptics, what are you referring
people
to?
People who don't believe in climate change, sort of like say it's the sun and things like that. Yeah. I mean, there's a whole bunch of studies out there on this that sort of like show analysis of how much change there can be in the sun and so on, which is not to say if there wasn't a really big change in the sun, it wouldn't would affect our climate. Of course it would, right? But the sun's actual overall variation in terms of luminosity is very well studied. And so there is a small change, but the changes that we get, it's about 0.1%. The changes that we get on the percent levels are coming for the change in carbon dioxide, right? And so when you have a really, really complicated system, you can't just sit there and explain everything in a really easy way, because it's so complicated that you kind of have a gross handle on how things work. And that's why climate models, no one will say they're absolutely perfect. They're not, right? They just give us general ideas of how the climate is going to evolve. And we try and do it better and better and better to understand all of the different factors. Yeah. But it's very, very complicated.
So the argument that we once had an ice age, obviously, at one point, this would have been tropical. Obviously, climate always changes. What's the big deal? What's the response
right,
to that?
I mean, it's easy to say things naturally change, because they do.
They do, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But the thing is, when you look at what's changing right now, it's changing far faster than any evidence we have in the geological record, right? It's not to say there couldn't be something hidden there somewhere, but it doesn't seem to be the case, right? And you can trace things pretty well to the overall increases in CO2 from human emissions. We can estimate that pretty easily as well. So it really looks like there is a connection between the two. And I mean at the 95% level, according to the experts.
Right. I thought you were going to say 95.7%. That was bad, wasn't it?
I was going to say, what is it? It's not News 95.7 time, it's News 95.7%.
Percent time, yes. 95.7% of the time. Yeah, that's right. So we will continue with Science Files. We need a break. We want your calls. So we've got somebody on the line. We would like to hear from you. What's your question? 902-405-6000 or 877-801-8255. We'll be right back with Rob Thacker in the Science Files. The Science Files with Rob Thacker continues, 902-405-6000 or 877-801-8255. Before we go back to the phone, somebody called and asked a question, something about a sinkhole. Katie, was it? Do you mind jumping on there and asking that question?
Yes, they were curious about what happens to the ground when a sinkhole occurs.
Where's
so like the one
go?
In Oxford,
sure.
Where did the ground
okay.
go?
Okay so sure. With many sinkholes, I won't say everyone, but with many sinkholes, what you're literally seeing is either a collapse or in fact that water volume is literally just eroding away the underground structures. And so generally, it just takes an increase in the amount of water that's flowing underground to start moving stuff along. So that's where the ground is gone. It's literally been moved by the underground water to another place somewhere else. And that is what leads to the weakening and the eventual collapse.
Okay, sounds good. Let's go back to the phones. Jay, how are you?
Not too bad. How are you?
Doing well. Go ahead.
Hey, Mr. Roth. How are you doing today?
Good, thanks. How are you?
Good, thanks. Just curious, I was watching a documentary last night about the moon landing and the 50 years and all that fun stuff, and it's just amazing that all the technology they had back in 1969 to accomplish that, and here we are in the year 2019, and you'd almost think we'd be at like another, you know, another planet by now with all the technology.
Sure. I mean, yes, it's incredible what they achieved in 1969 with the equivalent power of today's pocket calculator. I mean, not even your phone, right? Your phone is a supercomputer compared to what they had even in the mid-1970s.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I was also watching another little documentary a couple weeks ago, and they were talking about the Kepler, the Earth 2.0.
Yes.
And I thought it was so mind-boggling how they were saying, like, it would take, like, 30 years to get there. And in that time, like, the Earth would have went through, like, 1,500 of our Earth years.
Oh, yeah. So I can understand what that is.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. So that is actually something called time dilation, right? And that happens because of Einstein's theory of relativity, that when you move very, very fast, it appears that time slows down for you. Right. So we can actually, if we could build a spaceship that went fast enough, as close enough to the speed of light, which would be about 99.9% the speed of light. And there's no way in heck we can do that right now. We literally have no idea how we would do that. Then you would actually see that time slows down for you as you travel. And so that would be one way that we could actually get to a very distant star within a human lifetime. But there's no technological way we know of right now to build a spacecraft to do that and travel that fast. So we're kind of stuck.
Okay, yeah.
Right.
Thanks.
It was quite mind-boggling, actually. Yep. Quite interesting. And ever since that, I've been kind of just watching all these documentaries and just kind of pretty fascinating, actually.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Google time dilation.
As well. Yep. I'm sorry?
Google time dilation. You'll blow your mind with some of the things you'll find on that.
Thanks, Jay.
Okay,
appreciate it very much. And to me, the Apollo 11, obviously the documentary, the CNN films, Apollo 11, the scope that it realized to me was the magnitude of the infrastructure, first of all, but the design build. They didn't have open source software they could share, and I mean, just the blueprints would be staggering, and how they would coordinate all of that would be mind-boggling, right?
I mean, the thing that I always point to is that Apollo 11 was a tour de force of what we call control engineering, right? You look back at how they built those systems to work together. You look at the enormous number of people they had doing monitoring jobs now. I mean, there would be fractions of the number of people in mission control from the 1969 compared to what you have now, because a lot of stuff is actually monitored by computers now. But nonetheless, they took a very sensible engineering approach. They built software systems at the very low level, right? They did very simple things, and that allowed them to build in sort of like assessments of what was going wrong. So there's this 1202 alarm as they're going down. And immediately someone said, 1202 alarm, what does that mean? And so they went back and they were like, oh, it's instruction overflow. It can't process. There's too many things coming in. It's only a problem if this carries on. And it went away, came back very quickly, then went away. So they were okay. Nowadays, we would probably never face something like that, right? It would be very unlikely because we have enough computing power literally to land it wherever. I mean, you could build AI systems that would do what Armstrong was doing himself, right? And that's how things have changed. But overall engineering, right, building a rocket engine and so on, that hasn't come on in the same leaps and bounds that we have in electronics.
Right, absolutely. One last caller. Kathleen, go ahead.
Hello, how are you?
Doing well.
Good,
go
thanks.
Ahead, Kathleen.
Good. Okay, so the reason that we have global warming is, and I'm trying to get this straight here, is because we are putting too many CO2 emissions in the air, and it is creating...
That's a theory.
It's lessening the ozone layer.
Mm-hmm. The ozone layer doesn't matter too much in this case.
Okay.
Right, but you're...
I thought that was the reason, sorry.
No, the ozone layer is a separate issue related to ultraviolet emissions coming down to the surface. It's a cause for concern, absolutely. But global warming is primarily about carbon dioxide. You can think of it literally, the more carbon dioxide we put into the atmosphere, the bigger the blanket we put around the Earth, and it keeps sort of like heat in. That's kind of a good analogy for what's happening.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
I thought it was the opposite way around, that the sun was coming in, but... Yeah, that's great. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen. No, I appreciate it. We had some great calls today. How would you gauge the calls today out of 10?
They were awesome. I mean,
they
11.
Were like an 11 out of 10, right?
Our amplifiers go up.
Would
to
you
11,
say the
mate.
Quality of the whole thing was better without Rick here or less?
Oh, I'm so diplomatic. I will sit on
it's
the fence.
It's always less. It's
and
always
get
less.
Splinters in my bum.
There you go. Yeah, there you go. Just kidding. Are you back next week? I'm not sure.
I will be. Yeah, I'm not going
Science
anywhere.
Science
files.
So you're coming
weeks.
Back
yeah,
next
yeah,
week.
Yeah.
So you sent me a whole bunch of stuff. Oh, we're off Monday. That's right. Exactly. Well, you and I come in and chat on our own. How's that sound?
No,
maybe not.
I might be on the golf course.
So you sent me a whole bunch of stuff, and I didn't get to any of it, including the Planet Killer. Just in 30 seconds, what was that Planet Killer
story?
It
wasn't Planet Killer. It was City Killer.
City Killer,
asteroid.
Sorry.
I mean, that came at us from the direction of the sun, so we didn't see it until it would have been too late if it hit us. But it didn't hit us, and it was probably between 60 meters and 120 meters, which could do a fair amount of damage to a city, but it wouldn't destroy a continent.
We need.
Like
we
didn't
need to send Bruce Willis and the gang up to send their nukes.
No,
into
we
it?
Didn't need to send no. Bruce. No.
Sounds
next
good.
One.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate it very much. As always, Rob Thacker with the Science Files. When we come back, an open hour, 902-405-6000 or 877-801-8255. What is on your mind on this Monday? It is Manic Monday. We'll get to it after the news.